Okay.
Thank you so much, everyone. Thank you so much, Jess, for joining us this afternoon. And it will be great, Jess, if you would like to introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your work, how you came to love fungi, and what your perspectives are, and you know, future work. And then we can dive into the presentation, have a discussion afterwards.
Okay. I'll try and share my screen at some point. And I, because of technical issues, I'll also have to use my phone to read my presenter notes, because some of the slides have numbers on, and it's always good to give the right number. So thank you everyone for joining. Some of you have heard this before. I've tried to make it interdisciplinary, but feel free to ask me lots of questions if you want to. I am currently a postdoc in John Carr's lab, and John, you can see John here in the blue shirt. But the work I'm going to present now was actually done when I was a postdoc at the biochemistry department, also at Downing site, so not a very long move. And this was done in the lab of George Salmond. As I said to Francesca earlier, my background is not in plant sciences or not even in any kind of food science. I'm a biologist by training and a microbiologist who is now trying to learn the plant biology, which is great fun. Plants, mushrooms, however, are not plants. So that's a whole other thing. Let's see if I can manage just the screen sharing. Okay. Are you now seeing like a whole screen thing? Excellent. Perfect. So I was also asked to come up with a catchy title for this seminar. So I renamed it from something quite dry and scientific to Fantastic Fungi and How to Keep Them Healthy, because that's nice. Quite fun. The subtitle, Using Bacteriophages for Brown Blot Prevention, can seem like a lot of big words, but I'll try and explain everything. As I said, this is work that was done in George Salmond's laboratory at the Department of Biochemistry in Cambridge. It's basically finished and we're trying to write up the paper, but as everything, it takes time. So, why is this not working? Trying to change slides. Okay, just clicking. Right, let's talk about mushroom farming, and more specifically the farming of Agaricus bisporus, which is the most commonly farmed mushroom there is. You may have seen it as button mushrooms, white mushrooms, chestnut mushrooms, or portobello mushrooms. They're all the same species, slightly different varieties. Chestnut mushrooms and portobello mushrooms are typically brown. The other ones are typically white, but that's a small mutation. And if they're sold as button mushrooms or as large mushrooms, that just depends on when you pick them, really. So I've been lucky enough to go to a few mushroom farms around in East Anglia. And mushrooms are grown in bank beds. You can see here, they're sort of grown in stories like this. So they're grown very, very densely. And well, obviously they have people to pick them and they're picked by hand. So they sort of learn when to pick them, because if they grow too tightly, they will become a bit misformed. So you pick them early and you get these small white ones. You can sell them as button mushrooms and charge enough for them. Or you can pick them later and have larger mushrooms. Essentially. So mushroom farming, this is me trying to make things interdisciplinary. I don't know economics at all, but I looked up at the FAO, Food Agriculture Organization. The mushroom farming, as you can see here, it goes from the 1961, I think, up till today. It has obviously increased in value. This is in basically $1 million. Something happened around the year 2000, I don't know, maybe mushrooms somehow became more popular. And just to give it some kind of perspective to this, I was trying to find another food source that is roughly the same. Here we go. So this red line is mushroom and truffles, and the blue line here, the blue dots, are the production value or farming value of peppers. Satish, I know you like peppers and chilies. It says green, but I think that means not dry, essentially. So they're roughly about the same value. So you can see it's been a large increase in mushroom production value since the 60s, about 20-fold or something like that. And the gross production value was estimated to be about $46 billion two years ago. But if you look, so they're producing about the same amount of money. And if you look at the farming area, this is not zero, but it's sort of hovering around just about zero. For some reason, the mushroom value stopped around 1990. But what we can tell is that mushroom farming is very much area efficient. You can see before that as they grow in bunk beds, and they're grown very, very densely. And mushrooms also have several flushes per year, so you can harvest them all year round. They don't need specific lighting. I mean, a little bit specific lighting, but you don't have to grow them outside or on the free land. So they're very efficient in terms of farming area, which is good. But everything that's good also maybe has a backside. So mushrooms are susceptible to several kinds of disease and problems. Some are viral, some are other fungus like mold growing on the mushrooms, but they can also have bacterial infections. And what I'm going to talk about today is something called brown blotch, which is caused by a bacterium called Pseudomonas tulasi. Brown blotch is not dangerous to humans, but it makes the mushrooms look a bit like you don't want to buy them. They look a bit disgusting. So sometimes you can see these brown blotches. Sometimes they're just because the mushrooms have been handled a bit too violently and a bit too roughly. But sometimes, especially if they're a bit darker like this, this blotch is actually due to a bacterial infection. Like you can just cut it away and it's fine. But people tend not to buy mushrooms that look like this, and this causes production loss and sales losses. And if it's really bad, if you get an infection like this in the actual bed where you're growing, in the casing where the mushrooms are grown, you may have to scrap the entire batch of mushrooms, which is obviously not good at all. So Pseudomonas, you may have heard about before, especially Pseudomonas aeruginosa, which is a human and animal pathogen, can cause pneumonia, not nice at all. There's also a cluster down here called, this is the Pseudomonas fluorescens cluster, so it's quite widespread and diverse cluster. In here we find Pseudomonas tulasi, the causative agent of brown blotch. Pseudomonas tulasi, if you look at it very closely, it's not a very defined species, but for the case of this talk, I will call it a species. So as all Pseudomonas, it's a gram-negative bacterium. It lives in soil and compost, which is where you grow mushrooms, and it causes the brown blotch disease, essentially making the mushrooms very unhappy. They cause this disease by excreting, so Pseudomonas tulasi is causing the disease by excreting something called tulasin, which is a biosurfactant, and it essentially damages the mushroom cells on the surface and releases liquid and causes pitting and miscoloring, basically. So people are obviously trying to prevent brown blotch by using good hygiene, using bleach to make sure everything is clean, hydrogen peroxide. It's also quite good to reduce the amount of moisture in the air in the halls where the mushrooms are grown. But unfortunately, you can't just simply sterilize the compost or the casing where the mushrooms are grown, because there are other kinds and other species of Pseudomonas that are important for mushroom pinning and mushroom growth. So we need more specific means to target Pseudomonas tulasi specifically. And here is where my favorites, the bacteriophages, come in. So you may wonder, what are bacteriophages? Well, they're the viruses specific to bacteria. They're harmless to animals and harmless to plants. They're constantly evolving because they're viruses. And we have all learned the hard way that viruses are constantly evolving. Different phages, we call them phages for short, have different bacterial hosts. Different phages use different receptors that are molecular surfaces on the surface, molecular structures on the surface of the bacterial cell. And bacteriophages are extremely abundant in the environment. it's estimated that there are about 10 to the 31 phage particles on Earth, and that's the most common, the most abundant biological particle there is. So this is just a schematic showing free phage. They're always represented like some kind of insect moon landing kind of feature. So they attach on the surface of a bacterial cell, inject their DNA, this blue thing here. This is the bacterial DNA. The phage injects its DNA, forces the bacterium to replicate the phage DNA and make phage proteins, which then assemble into new phage particles that then lyse the bacterial cell, and the whole thing starts all over again. So the aims of this project was to isolate bacteriophages against Pseudomonas tulasi. Could we do it at all to begin with? And if we could, what are they? Can we use them for biocontrol? And if it's interesting, what kind of receptors, what kind of surface structures do they use to recognize Pseudomonas tulasi and not other bacteria? So biocontrol is a way to use biological agents to control other biological agents, broadly speaking. And this image is from something called APS Biocontrol. I think it's a Scottish company. They, in this case here, they spray a phage solution over potatoes, potato tubers, to prevent bacterial infections in the potato tuber to prolong shelf life, essentially. So it is being used. So we want to take Pseudomonas tulasi, which I will always represent looking like this, mix them with phage that we'll find somehow, and then hopefully see if Pseudomonas tulasi dies. So how do you get the phage? It's not like you can go to the store and buy them. How do you get them? Well, we isolate them. We enrich and isolate, and I'll walk you through how I do this. It may look complicated, but it's something you can do in a week or two. So I started out by going and collecting samples. Lots of it were from water, just normal water from the River Cam. But I also took some sort of disgusting looking mushrooms from the supermarket, or even some casing from the mushroom farm. And these solid things I then just mixed up with some water, just to like release anything that was in there. I then filtered the samples to make sure that there were no bacteria in the sample at all. But because phages are so small, they slip through the filter and hopefully are in the filtered sample then, which is here, it's represented by these colorful hexagons. So there's a chance that there is phage in the filtered sample, which is good. I then take a culture of my bait strain, Pseudomonas tulasi, here. Mix it in a liquid culture together with the filtered sample, and then wait for a number of days and let them grow. And the hope is that any of these phages that are possibly present in the filtered sample will attach, replicate, grow, lyse, and multiply essentially in this culture. This culture is then, I take samples from it, and the samples are chloroform treated to kill off any of the bait strains, to just to keep the phage that has then been multiplied, basically. And this sample, so all of this is done blindly, but here comes the actual assessment. So this sample is then mixed with a fresh culture of the bait strain to see if I get this kind of plucking pattern. So what you see as a hazy background is bacteria growing as a lawn. And these little dots that you can see, they look dark on the image, but they're actually see-through, which means that the phage, every single dot here is a plaque, and every plaque is a single phage that has been growing and eating and multiplying on the plate, basically prohibiting the bacteria from growing there. So these plaques are then picked and multiplied and so on. So that's how you enrich and isolate phages. So we did this a number of times, and we came up with five phages that you could quite easily divide up into two groups. So don't worry about the names, but the sort of green group and the purple group. And the green group, so this is just a zoom in on these plaques. The green group causes like turbid plaques. They're see-through, but it's not clear see-through. Whereas the purple group causes absolutely clear, crystal clear plaques. You can see right through them. So it kind of looks like they're a bit different. If you want to look at phages more physically, like see how they look like, you have to use transmission electron microscopy or some other kind of electron microscopy. And they all look roughly the same. They're about 50 to 100 nanometers across. This is the little head. They have a little short stubby tail. You can't really see it, but it's very likely that they also have these kind of leg-like structures, which you can classify them as Podoviridae or Otographiniviridae. So Podoviridae means foot virus because it looks like they have a short stubby tail, which is like a foot sitting like this. So they look, they all kind of look the same, but if you look at the plaque formation, it's there looks like there is a difference. So we then did what is quite common. We wanted to have a look at their genomes. And lo and behold, the green group and the purple group were quite different if you look at the genomes. They look similar morphologically, but if you look at the genomes, they fall into two quite differential groups. So everything that's in bold here are the phages that I and my colleagues isolated, and they're then compared. So here's a genome. This is just the genome represented, and the red bars between the genomes is the similarity between the genomes. So the more red something is, the more similar it is. So this top thing here is a phage that was already discovered by someone else, and the sequence was published online. And this is the sequence that was most similar to the ones that I found. So the green group would then classify as something called Vicosavirus. They're pretty similar to each other, and they're pretty similar to something that was already published. If you look at the clear plaque forming group, MB56 and MB8, they're very similar to each other. And they're also quite similar to something called PSA2, which has been published and discovered by someone else. And these belong to a group called Guna virus. So I'm just going to check if I have anything that I'm missing. Right. So we then took the we took one representative from each group. So I worked mainly with MB56 from the Vicosavirus group, and MB55 from the Vicosavirus group, and MB56 from the Guna virus group, because they seemed so similar. We just picked one representative from each group and did some biocontrol tests. This is a very crude test, but essentially I took mushrooms, I cut off the cap, flipped it upside down so I had a flat surface, and then I added either just growth medium or growth medium with bacteria or growth medium with bacteria and phage. And then you can see the results here. So with just growth medium, and then I measured, after 24 hours, I measured a pitting zone if I could see any. With just growth medium, there is no pitting zone. If you add just bacteria, just Pseudomonas tolassi, you get a quite clear pitting zone. It's actually sunken down and it's brown, and it's like 22 millimeters across on average. If you add, so these orange bars here represent Pseudomonas tolassi with added Vicosavirus MB55, and the green bars here represent Pseudomonas tolassi with added Vicosavirus MB56. MOI is multiplicity of infection, it says here, and you can see it's either one phage per bacterium or 10 phage particle per bacterium. There is no statistical difference between having one or having 10, but it kind of looks like a trend. Obviously we can't say there is, but it looks like a trend. But it definitely looks like adding phage, these four bars here, definitely makes the pitting zone smaller than having no phage. So it's a promising sign. So we know that the biocontrol seemed to work in our very crude assay. So what are the phages really, what are they recognizing on the surface? For Vicosavirus, for Guna virus, MB56 and the other clear plaque forming viruses, it's been studied quite a lot, and I'll come back to that, but that's sort of figured out already. But for the Vicosavirus, it's not been studied. So we wanted to study that. So the phage sits on the surface and obviously recognize something, but what is it? So we had a very talented part 3 student who did random mutagenesis of wild type Pseudomonas thomasi and then selected for resistance to phage. So the bacteria had then changed something, presumably on their surface, which meant that they could no longer be recognized by phages and no longer killed by the phages. So we did some sequence analysis and came up with the candidate genes and for the disrupted genes and surface structures that would be disrupted as well. So they basically fell into two groups. Pseudomonas thalassi that were resistant to Vicosa virus either had changes in exopolysaccharides or in lipopolysaccharide. What is that, you may wonder? LPS or lipopolysaccharides are sort of fatty acids, sugar structures that are anchored in the cell wall. Exopolysaccharides are sugar molecules that are excreted from the cell and are then important for biofilm formation. So they're all on the surface and they're not too dissimilar to each other. Interestingly, it's, I said, the Guna virus phages, the clear plaque forming phages, their receptor has already been studied and that's been found to be LPS. So that's quite interesting, actually. I'll come back to that as well. So the phages can then either recognize LPS or exopolysaccharides. As I said, disrupted LPS gives resistance to the Vicosa virus, but it also causes a cross-resistant to Guna virus. So we took the phages and the bacteria that the part three student had been selecting to be, so he selected them to be resistant to Vicosa virus. So here's a wild type Pseudomonas thalassi, and you can see MB55 up here causes plaques. This is just a dilution series. MB56 also causes plaques, obviously. If you look at the exopolysaccharide mutants, MB55, which is the phage that were selected to be resistant against, does not cause any plaques, whereas the purple thing down here, MB56, does cause plaques. If you look at the LPS mutant, which remember has been selected to be resistant to MB55, but it's also resistant to MB56, there are no plaques there. So that's quite interesting. So we have changed receptors. Does that mean we have any kind of changed virulence? So we went back to the virulence assay, and this is just what I showed you before. Having no bacteria means basically no pitting. Adding bacteria, lots of pitting. Adding bacteria plus phage, less pitting. But what happens if we add the mutant bacteria that can no longer be recognized by phage? This is quite complex, but it's essentially pairs. So if you look at the gray bars, they represent the pitting zone of the mutant bacteria, and the checkered bar next to them represent the mutant bacteria together with the phage that they are presumably resistant against. And you can see that they are actually resistant because there's no difference between them. What is interesting about this is the LPS mutant, actually it doesn't matter if you add the phage, that it doesn't do anything. But if you look at the gray bar here, it causes less pitting than the wild type Pseudomonas thalassi just on its own. Sorry, there's something on the. Okay. So having a mutated LPS makes Pseudomonas thalassi resistant to both kind of phages that we isolated, but it also makes it less virulent on mushrooms. So we have isolated Vicosa virus and Guna virus phages active against Pseudomonas thalassi. We figured out what receptors they use, namely LPS and exopolysaccharide. And both of these phages have, or both types of phages have a biocontrol potential against brown blotch. So essentially we have mushrooms that are not happy at all being infected with bacteria. We add phage, mushrooms very happy, mushroom farmers are happy. Thank you so much for listening. And I want to thank George Salmon, obviously, and Yugeng Zhang, who was this very talented part three student. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Jess. That's really fascinating. And thank you so much for making it kind of comprehensible. So to people who are not in the field and very, you know, in a bit more interdisciplinary, which is fantastic. I am sure there will be questions. I wonder very quickly if you can tell me, I don't know if you know that, but does the location where mushrooms are grown impact on the, you know, on the but on the virus, or it doesn't really have an impact at all?
I don't know why everything turned. What do you mean by location? Do you mean like geographical location or?
No, well, maybe even geographical, but no, I was thinking, you know, now they are mostly grown, mushrooms are mostly grown indoors.
Yes.
In these massive tunnels with no light.
Mm.
And traditionally, of course, we think of mushrooms grown outdoors. Does that make a difference?
That's a good question. I don't know. What I do know is that mushrooms, as we know from foraging, mushrooms in the forest, they like when it's quite moist. And if you keep the growing tunnels too dry, the mushroom go a bit flaky, and that also look a bit unappetizing. So some mushroom growers think that it would be nice to be able to water mushrooms or water the beds where they grow. But they can't do that because if it's too moist, Pseudomonas tulasi and various molds and other disgusting things also like it. So you can't water mushrooms. You can't water them when they have pinned, I think. It's something, some kind of limitation to that. So one kind of hope that we had with this was that we would be able to formulate some kind of spray, a bit like the potato thing that I showed, to be able to water the mushrooms with the phage solution, because then you could water them, you could get better yield, but also no bacteria. So, but yeah, I don't know if you grew them outside or if, so reducing the moisture does help.
Mm-hmm.
Growing them outdoors, I think, would be difficult to keep everything in a sort of controlled environment.
Mm-hmm. Okay, because I was wondering about the light. Does the light have an impact on the formation of this virus?
I don't think so.
No, okay.
I mean, I might be wrong, but I don't think the light has mm-hmm. Makes a difference.
Okay, that's interesting. I was reading that China, of course, is number one
producer
and consumer of
yeah.
of mushrooms in the world, and they have this massive, buildings using on a mass scale mushrooms.
So yes.
That's interesting.
Yes, it's quite, as I showed, area efficient, but it doesn't mean that you can grow them anywhere, and it's better to have a controlled environment, essentially.
Yes, exactly.
Mm.
I have more questions and comments, but I'd like to open up the discussion. Please, anyone would like to ask a question or make a comment?
Yeah.
I can see the sub of the account.
Hi, Jessica.
Hi.
Really great presentation. I just wondered, did you observe any other fitness costs with your LPS mutants?
Thanks for asking. I did not include that, but I have some extra slides.
I was just wondering, like, if you know how likely they would be to evolve in the mushroom production systems as well.
Yeah. So. I think every all the mutants had roughly the same growth rate, and so the LPS mutant is this WAP H2, so the aerobic growth rate is the same as the wild type. It was a little bit downregulated in the swarming ability, but it was actually more, it was upregulated in cell attachment or sort of biofilm formation. So except for mushroom pitting, It had no great effect on the fitness, so no massive fitness cost.
Yeah, I just wondered, do you have any thoughts on if you applied this phage, how long this mutant would take to evolve?
So I mean, that kind of depends on the starting population, right? Because all evolution depends on what pre-existing mutants you have.
I was going to ask at the beginning, because whether your two phages have different, interacted with different genes, but this LPS gene, they both affect this one.
Do you have any plans? LPS can also, it's regulated by several genes. I suppose, I'm no expert on LPS, but I guess that it is a quite large genetic target, as is hexapolysaccharide formation. It's a specific hexapolysaccharide, but I didn't want to go into all the details. I guess it's a quite large genetic target, so I would imagine that it's quite likely that it would evolve and arise.
Mm-hmm.
The mutants. It's a good question.
Thank you, Charlotte. Any more questions or comments?
Yes, John?
Yeah, John.
Would the answer to Charlotte's question be do people use a cocktail of a phage, like one that's against, this is going to bind to the exopolysaccharide rather than to the LPS?
Mm.
Is that the way one would tackle that, so that you'd have to have two, you know, simultaneous mutations in two different two different synthetic pathways? Would that be the way of doing it?
That would be a good way of doing it. And for that reason, the Vicosa virus and the Guna viruses are not the best cocktail, because the Vicosa viruses can bind to the hexapolysaccharides and the LPS, so they can sort of pick and choose a little. Mm-hmm. It would be nice to have two groups of phages that bind to completely different structures.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, a bit like using antibiotic cocktails for patients, you could use phage cocktails, and I think that would be the way forward, yes.
Okay. Oh, plus I liked your talk, I should have said that first.
That's very kind.
Sorry.
Hello, Andrew, do you want to ask something?
Andrew, yes.
Sorry, I can't hear you. I think you're muted. No, you're not muted. It's just something with your audio. No.
You want to write it down, Andrew?
You can write it down and I'll read it.
We've lost Andrew. No.
I can see him, but I can't hear anything.
Is he writing? No, I don't think
so. It looks like he's looking down, so he might be looking at the keyboard.
Okay. Maybe we are waiting for Andrew to come back. Anyone else? More questions or comments? I have a very basic question, Jess, actually. I mean, do these mushrooms, when they've been affected by the virus, can they be used for anything else?
Do you mean if they're safe for human consumption, or if they...
But also if they were not safe for human consumption, could, say, proteins or other elements be extracted and then used? I mean, I know the mushrooms have a massive amount of waste.
Yeah.
And so there's quite a lot of work in reducing that waste and using effectively that waste in other ways. So I was wondering if you know anything about that.
I don't know. I mean, as phages are not, they're specific for bacteria. So mushrooms that are treated with phages would be safe for human consumption. Obviously, it would have to be tested and approved, obviously, by some kind of food safety authority. But they definitely should be safe. If you can use mushrooms for something else, lots of proteins are expressed in yeast, for example. But that's not real. I mean, those are yeast cells in suspension and not the fruiting body. And I don't know how common it is to use mushroom fruiting bodies for expression of other things. I've not heard about it.
Okay, I understand. So unless they've been treated, then they can't be safe.
I think they would be safe. I think they would be safe anyway.
Okay.
So the Pseudomonas salicis isn't harmful for humans.
So it's just a cosmetic.
Yes. Yeah. It looks a bit disgusting, and if the pitting goes too deep, there's like no mushroom left, essentially. Mm-hmm. But just a little bit of pitting on the surface isn't bad for you. Just cut it away and it's fine.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So Andrew says, sorry for the lack of audio. Do you have any data on how prevalent these phages are in mushroom production environments already? Have you tried mass sequencing samples from mushroom farms? That's a very good question. No, we have not. We don't have any data on this at all. It would be interesting. What we did do, related to this project, but slightly different. So we also, there was a continuation on this project done by an MPhil student. And so he wanted to isolate phages that were sort of more from the mushroom growing environment. And he also wanted to isolate, he had gotten from Fera different strains of Pseudomonas tolassi. So I used only one strain, which is a common lab strain, but it's not super virulent. So he had access to other more virulent Pseudomonas tolassi strains. And he also had mushroom farmers around Great Britain and Northern Ireland, I think, sending him compost samples, and I think even some mushroom samples, to try and isolate phages. But those were used to isolate specific phages against specific bacterial strains, and we did not use them for mass sequencing. So that would have been very interesting to see if you could get some kind of arms race. But so we don't have any direct data, but we obviously know that sometimes there are outbreaks of brown blotch. And if there had been a mass abundance of these good phages, maybe we would see less outbreaks. So I think they definitely could be around, but not in enough numbers to prevent outbreaks, because there still are outbreaks. But it would be interesting to know the numbers. I don't know if that answers your question, but
yes, well, thank you for the answer.
Oh, thanks.
Yes. Do you know anyone else who works in mushrooms in Cambridge, Jess?
So George is retiring now, and his MPhil student has finished. I know there was a professor at Plant Sciences about 20, 25 years ago, Keith Johnston, who did lots of work on Pseudomonas tolassi and on tolassin, the actual toxin. And that's regulated in a very, they did quite a lot of work on this, but he's not there anymore. I don't know. I'd be happy to know.
Okay. Maybe I can. Well, that's probably my role in finding out, and it would be great to to connect with others, and yes, especially other disciplines. I was wondering if Andrew was able to now open the mic, but no, it's fine. Anyone else? Any more questions or comments?
Yeah, John.
I just wondered how stable, once you obviously you can keep phage in a fridge for a long time and then chlorophyll and things like that. But once they're out in, suppose you had a way of misting the compost.
Yeah.
How long, does anybody know how long these particles are stable for? Do they have a good survival in the environment, or are they basically eaten by something?
It's a good question. I guess people have done studies on it, but I don't know the answer. I would imagine that they're pretty stable. I mean, they're essentially just bags of protein, right? They don't, they haven't got a cell membrane, so they would be quite stable.
Okay.
Different phages are differently stable, I don't know. Maybe Charlotte has an answer or a comment.
Oh no, mine's not. I was just wondering, are the main losses pre-harvest then, when the mushrooms are growing, and are there any? Is there post-harvest loss as well? Just thinking about the application of the phages, might be easier, like with the potatoes post-harvest, and whether that would make a difference or not.
Yes, I think there is definitely both pre-harvest and post-harvest losses, and the post-harvest losses because mushrooms have a relatively short shelf life, and they kind of go off a little, and people don't buy them. So it would be nice if you could treat them with phage after harvest. I think, I don't know if that's what is more common, but my feeling is that the sort of post-harvest loss keeps happening on a sort of low rate all the time, but sometimes you get outbreaks of sort of Anaselacia brown blotch in the growing facilities, and then you have like massive pre-harvest losses. Mm-hmm. So in a way, it would be good if you could treat both the compost and the actual harvested mushrooms.
And it has to be delivered in a liquid?
Not necessarily. I mean, it's just easier because I think you would have to do it in a liquid because that's how I know how to grow phage, but you wouldn't have to spray it necessarily. Maybe you could mix it in with the compost and the casing materials. Mushrooms are grown in a mix of compost and or like chicken manure and peat or something like that. Or coconut coir or something. So maybe you could mix it with that and then hope that's the main source of bacteria.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for a really interesting talk.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jess. But can this be preempted? I mean, can it be avoided?
I mean, you can reduce the amount of Pseudomonas talasi with these precautions that I talked about mm-hmm. before, mm-hmm. reducing moisture and so on, and keeping things as clean as you can. Mm-hmm. We don't know if it can be completely abandoned or completely preempted. Mm-hmm. I guess it's dangerous to say that it definitely can, but we hope that we could at least reduce the amount. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I think Charlotte has another question or comment.
Sorry, just another one. I was just thinking, is much known about the interaction between Pseudomonas and the mushroom? Is there any resistance that could be, I guess, engineered maybe in?
Yeah, that's another way to go to engineer the mushroom so that it wouldn't be susceptible anymore. You could, depending on how you do it, you would also have the issue of having genetically engineered food and having that, you know, approved.
I don't know how.
So there are. So much? Sorry.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to say.
Yeah, sorry. Go on. I'll be quiet.
I was just going to ask if there is much mushroom breeding carried out.
I don't know about mushroom breeding. I guess there is, but I don't know. So I said that chestnut mushrooms, the brown ones, and the white mushrooms, they're both Agaricus bisporus. The brown mushrooms, the chestnut ones, they are much less susceptible to Pseudomonas talasi. They also give a lower yield when you grow them, so it sort of evens out on that, but they're not at all as resistant. And before I knew this, I just went and bought a box of mushrooms and did my experiments on, but I couldn't find the white ones, so I did it on the brown ones, and you could tell they were similar, but they were not quite the same. So when I cut it open and like flipped over the top, I usually drop a little drop of bacterial suspension on, and it sort of sucks in immediately, but for the brown mushrooms they didn't, so they had like a surface tension almost on it's not liquid, but some kind of other structure on the surface. So they seem to be, they're less susceptible, and the farmers then confirmed that brown mushrooms and chestnut mushrooms are less susceptible to Pseudomonas talasi. So there is definitely something that could be worked on that. But they also give a lower yield, so it's a sort of swings and roundabout situation. Yes, John?
Yeah, I would guess the coloration is due to melanin.
Yes.
Because that's hydrophobic, and it tends to increase the fungi that have melanin. And I don't really know about pathogens, but you know, it's a key component in enabling them to control our water relations and so on, and also repel substances.
Yes. But do you think so? Would that be expressed even on the sort of white inside of a chestnut mushroom? Because that white inside was also less prone to take up liquid.
It may not take very much or something, or mm-hmm. you know, just because the if the outside, well, I know because you cut it in half, but
yeah,
there's probably you know, it tends to sort of be mixed in with the chitin a bit at the you know, the edge of the cell wall of the the hypha. I'm talking, you know, I'm slightly talking bollocks here as usual, because I teach this stuff in first year, so I had to learn some of it, but I'm slightly extending this to areas I don't really know about. So
it was a long time since I had a first year lecture, so please.
I tend to forget it. It all drips out of my head after I forget. I do it.
Yeah. And it might seem a bit counterintuitive to, like, that I did the inoculation on the, like, inside of the mushroom cap, but that was because I wanted to keep things not sterile, but kind of clean. And sometimes I would see weird blotching on the outside, and I just wanted a clean surface, a clean slate. So that's as good as it got. But yeah, the melanin and hydrophobicity would be a good explanation. Why they grow slower or give lower yield, I don't know if that's related to the same thing or if it's something different.
Thank you, John. Any more questions or comments? No. Jess, I just wanted to ask a very last thing. Do you think, I mean, is this an area you would like to see more interaction with other disciplines? Are there, you know, aspects that we could explore?
So it's a little bit hard to say. This particular thing is like a finished project, and I've left this research group, and I'm now doing work on bacterial infections of plants with John Carr. But obviously my heart is still with the phages, and it's a lovely thing to do. So the continuation project that I touched upon, done by the MPhil student, that was done as a collaboration between, I think, FERA, University of Cambridge, and some mushroom growers, and that was quite good because it meant that they could do, and like another company, they could do some more real trials in a way of phage and phage solutions in actual mushroom growth and not just mushrooms from the supermarket.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason that never worked out really well, but I don't think it's because the phages wouldn't work. I think it's just it depends on how you apply them and when you apply them and how the mushrooms are grown.
Mm-hmm.
But it's always good to, like, have different experiences and different, let's see, to mix in a bit of reality, if that makes sense, to have the actual mushroom growers who can say what kind of problems they have. And I know that the people at FERA developed some qPCR assays to be able to tell what kind of bacterial infection there is, because there are similar symptoms that can be caused by slightly different Pseudomonas. So there's also something called ginger blotch, which is caused by Pseudomonas gingeri. It tends to be slightly less problematic, but it's there. So they developed some assays to, like, test for that. It's always good to have people of different backgrounds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because, I mean, obviously mushrooms are a source of loads of nutrients.
Yeah, absolutely.
It would be an amazing thing to invest more. And I'm not that sure. I suppose it's obviously a matter of trade agreements, you know, etc. But all the mushrooms that we seem to find in this country are all Irish. And surely, you know, we can produce them here as well. So I wonder why. Again, obviously, it's down to politics and as I said, trade agreements. But is there also another reason?
So one thing the mushroom growers said right at the very beginning was that, so they have these people who pick the mushrooms from the beds, and they tend to be seasonal workers, or they, like, come for a year or so. Mm-hmm. And usually they come from, I think they said, Romania and Bulgaria, possibly even from Ukraine, but that was long before the war. And they come and work for a year or 10 months or so, and then they come back. And they get really skilled, actually. You wouldn't think it, but it takes some kind of skill to figure out when to pick the mushrooms, to get the good small ones that look pretty, which mushrooms you should just pick and sort of scrap or sell cheap, and which ones would be allowed to grow out to these portobello-like nice ones that you can charge lots for. And obviously with Brexit, they were quite worried that having seasonal workers coming in from the EU would be more difficult. So maybe that's one reason. I know that lots of the mushrooms that I got to do the experiments, they were grown in the UK. But that was a few years ago. So it might be more, and I haven't actually checked the origins of mushrooms since then. But it might have been like that the Irish market is taking over now, maybe because they have more access to workers coming in.
Yeah, it could be. And then the other market they come from usually is Poland.
Yes, so Poland is a large producer. So the US, China, as you said, China is the largest one. The US produces a lot of mushrooms, but Poland and I think the Netherlands are big producers as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Interesting. So I think we need to pay more attention next time that we buy and eat a mushroom. There's a lot going on and a lot behind it, right? Wonderful. Thank you so much. Unless there are other burning questions or comments or anything final that you would like to add, Jess.
Just thanks for
thank you so much for thank you so much for joining us. That's been a really interesting discussion, and so have a good weekend, and I hope to see you next Friday to talk about bees, given that next Friday is World Bee Day.
I'm on annual leave next Friday.
Better. I hope
I'll come around some other Friday.
It will be a joint discussion. So there's somebody from zoology and somebody from archaeology. Oh. So it'll be really interesting to sort of hear the two different perspectives and talk about beekeepers, etc. So I hope to see some of you next week. Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a good weekend.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye. Bye-bye. Take care.